This is Jane and Joseph Wheelwright, June 17th, 1978, Intimacy, Tape 2 3.
Well, now I would like to say something about intimacy between men and men, and women and women, and men and women. I think I might start off with intimacy between men and men. I am, for my own part, and here I have to be autobiographical, more or less, I've had maybe four or five through my lifetime really close and intimate relationships with men, which I would have to say I don't just like them, I would have to say that I have loved them. Now, this doesn't mean that I wanted to monkey around with their apparatus or that they wanted to monkey around with mine. But it really was, there's real love in these relationships, and it's been of enormous importance. I would mention a few of these people through the years, Mike Fordham in London, Gerhard Adler in London, and in this country, Joe Henderson, and Gregory Bateson, an anthropologist who suffered from being Margaret Mead's husband for many years, but is no longer, and is really a very big person in his own right. And Eric Erickson, who belongs to the opposing club, but is a very original and creative fellow. And these have been, for my own development, relationships that have been of great meaning, and they have, on the whole, been shadow relationships. That is to say, in terms of types, they are all of them introverted, intuitive thinking types, and I'm an extroverted, intuitive feeling type. So that we have intuition. We can both climb into the old dirigible and zoom around, but outside of that, we come from absolutely opposite ends of the spectrum, and it's been enormously enriching, and of course we've had some terrible Donnybrooks with each other, but we've also cared enough so that we've resolved them. And so I have the feeling that this is a kind of intimacy that one experiences as a young fellow in school and in college, but that usually is set aside. But with me, I never have set it aside. And I consider that it's an awful lack if it isn't there. With women, it's a great joy to me. I'm quite an ardent women's liver, and I find it really, it's great joy to me to see relationship between women beginning of this sort, beginning to assume more and more importance. So often, relationships between women were, when I was young, they didn't have an awful lot of substance, and they, and if a man hove up on the horizon, that was the end of it. And I found this awfully distressing. I'm generalizing in a very loose way, of course. There were lots of exceptions to that. But at any rate, there are getting to be fewer and fewer, more and more exceptions to that, it's a pleasure to see. And I'm not going to talk much about that because I don't think men know anything about women. I'm sick and tired of hearing them all crying about women. I like to hear it from the women themselves. Well, I might say too that in the therapeutic situation, I think that intimacy is by no means a monopoly of feeling types. I think that it transcends either men or women, sex, or that it transgender, that is, or that it transcends types. I don't think it's limited to that. But I was thinking at the receiving end of analysis that I worked with Jung and with Tony at the same time. We thought that would be utter confusion. It turned out it wasn't, because they castrated such different things in me that there was no conflict at all. I remember once in 1953, I was in a very depressed state, and I went to see Tony, and because she was the best analyst I ever had, and for me. And I sat down in the room and I began to cry, and I couldn't seem to stop it. And after a while, she sat there patiently, and after a while, I quit, and she said, what's that? What is it about? And I looked at her and said, I'm a patient, and began to cry again. Because it had been 13 years drunk, where I had had to walk around as if I knew what I was doing and be so much more grown up than I really was, that suddenly the whole thing, you know. Just, well, now, that is was certainly an intimate interchange between the two of us, but it could never have occurred between me and Jung. Not that I didn't find my work with Jung very rewarding, but I felt really quite close to Jung, but that kind, particular kind of empathy, and neither, and Tony had no more of a feeling function than Jung did, and that's saying something. So, Jung was not noted for his feeling function. Very unnoted. You don't hear very much about that. I could regale you with stories that would just take your hair stand on end. But at any rate, I won't. I just want to say that from the point of view of the victim, not of the not of the analyst. And Jung did make the comment himself that the analytic relationship was a personal relationship, a personal relationship in an impersonal framework. And there's no question at all that with many people, Jung did have intimacy. I mean, had very intimate relations. No question. And he risked himself, and he certainly believed that the analyst should be just these things that I was saying earlier on, that the analyst should be part of the process, and that one way of checking up on it would be to see not if the analyst is changing, but if the patient is changing, but if you, you see my resistance, but if you, the analyst is changing too. That part is all but you can see it. And I also am saying, I would like to say that I don't think that intimacy is the only way to work with patients. It's necessary that it has to be established. For me, it happens to be the way. You see, I don't think there's any right way to do therapy, but I do think there's a right way for each person to do therapy. And I think that in working in training with people, that one tries terribly hard to develop the style, allow the individual, the trainee, to develop his or her, I'd rather say her or his, own style. But for some people, they don't work close in. I'm anathema to a lot of people because there are a lot of people who don't want to look up and feel the analyst breathing on them, you know, and crowding in on them. I think, good God, I'm being invaded here. I want to get out of here. And there are other people for whom that's the right thing. Now I am thinking of the intimacy. I'd like to make some comments and discuss the intimacy that occurred in, or may occur, not necessarily, that may occur in marriage, and the intimacy that may occur in a conjunctio situation, this is a little difficult. Really to talk about. I have some clinical material here which I will I'll read to you, but I'm thinking that in the kind of that marriage is in the public domain, and that although it probably starts out as a conjunctio thing, that when you become officially married and you go through the rituals and you start having children and you start participating as a family and the community, you're very much in the public domain, and you are, of course, beset, or you are beset by a really strong archetypal battering from outside and from inside, and between each other too, of course. So this is an enormously constant complicated thing in which there are many archetypes that one has to consider. You know, mother, father, sister, brother, good God, there's a gay life. When you come to the when you come to the conjunctural situation, then whatever existence it may have, it has for its own sake. It doesn't, and furthermore, it revolves more around, and it's private, and it revolves around one archetype. To be sure, that's pretty global archetype. The animus and the anima are rather large issues. I just make those comments because with many of us, something like this can happen. It's for instance, in being an analyst, I think perhaps one of the most perilous things is that nobody ever knows all the facets of his anima, or no woman knows all the facets of her animus. And she might be sitting in her office, and at 9 o'clock tomorrow, in comes a man, and all the bells start ringing, and Beethoven's Ninth strikes up, and the temptation to say, well, why do we bother to be, let's not have any analysis, let's just quit that right now, you know? And it gets to one. I shouldn't be so frivolous about such a serious subject. I guess I'm doing it partly because it is so serious. But in any case, that is an occupational hazard for analysts, and it's of course a hazard for any of us, because I suppose that there may be, to get to be arbitrary about it, say perhaps a half a dozen men with whom a woman could have a good life and a good marriage, and perhaps the same half a dozen women for a man. Well, maybe you marry the first one of this half dozen that comes along, or maybe you don't, and you marry the second. But then, supposing you marry the second, and then number three comes along, what do you do? Deny it, or do you not? The great American way, of course, is to buy a one-way ticket in Reno, and then you divorce whoever it is at number two, and you marry number three, and of course, by the very act of doing that, you have changed the whole point of the relationship, as well as disrupting children, and et cetera, et cetera. And so, I'm not awfully keen on that solution, I must say. But I would like to read a sketch. And by the way, I just will mention this. It's a description of the conjunctio thing by D.H. Lawrence that some of you may be familiar with. It's sort of a long, a short story, or a short long story, a short novel. It's called The Man Who Died. And in this he fancies that Christ pushes aside the stones blocking his tomb and emerges to heal first his body and then his spirit. And the real substance of the story concerns his ritualistic union with the priestess of Isis. She sees him as the lost Osiris, and he sees her as the mysterious, spiritual, pure woman through whom he can be made whole and for the first time be part of ordinary human life. In their relationship, they both experience the fusion of spirit and flesh, which is indeed a high form of religious experience. A child is conceived, which symbolizes the fruit of their union, and at this point, the experience is complete. And it remains for each of them to consciously incorporate the animus and anima values that they had projected on each other. It's very interesting that Guggeville, I don't know how many of you have read Guggeville's book on marriage. I find it fascinating. Of course, I may be a little prejudiced because I'm devoted to Eros, but in it, he says people have the idea that marriage is somehow a state of well-being, and everybody's supposed to be happy, and it's supposed to be just lovely in the Garden of Eden. When in fact, he said, marriage is really, it's an individuation process and no picnic. And it may involve having to undergo the strains of something happening so that some aspect of the animus anima that is not in the marriage can be worked out. It's rather, it's not a very conventional way to think. But at any rate, I find his work very, really very good, and he is very strong for holding the marriage together. But he expects there's going to be a lot of hurt, and it's not going to be that quick. Perhaps the best way, I have here James has the title of James' book is The Marriage Within, that the patient who was a dying patient that she worked with died in better relation to her husband because of it, and that note I had because after that Lawrence reading that sort of little summary thumbnail of the man who died, I wrote paradoxically this does not make for a split in the marriage, it actually consolidates it. And then I refer to James' title, The Marriage Within, and the fact that when a patient was dying that she did have this kind of relationship with the animus inside herself, not maybe pulled back in, and that this did improve the relationship with the husband, so that by the time she died they were in much better relationship. Perhaps the best way to summarize the roles of the animus and anima, and I think it's interesting to kind of to distinguish two between the reality-based intimacy and the projection intimacy. And of course, I'm a hound for the reality-based intimacy, but it all starts, obviously, with the projection thing, because I quarrel with my daughter, who gives me the image I have about Linda, wanting to do this global exhumation of one's little inside. I'm not sure very much of Linda would be scared that she would be saying this, but at any rate, this is how it strikes me, and I get a little bit the feeling that she thinks that somehow that if you roll your eyeballs inward and you get a trowel and you just take a big spoonful of stuff out of your liver, you can bring it up, and I don't think you can do that. I think the way you get stuff out of the unconscious is by the projection route. So I'm not down putting the projection thing. I think that it's the way it starts, but then what do you start peeling off the projections and beginning to establish the reality base? Because I think the more that you do that, the better. And I would say about the conjunctio thing that the whole point of it, of course, is an individuation thing. It has no place in the ordinary everyday life of whoever it is that's involved in it. And so the point of it is purely a developmental thing. But it is surely true that no man or no woman can possibly satisfy all the facets of the other one. I mean, that's just, it's just too bad, but that's the way that things can be in the rain. So here is a sketch of a man and a woman who went through a very critical situation, which is, I've just been talking about, and worked into a very full and very stable relationship. The woman's childhood had been a very vexed one. She had grown up in a small, isolated community where the constant and forced close contact with her mother resulted in an ongoing battle royal between them that lasted for many years. The mother was an intellectual, very poor domestic life, a typical animus-possessed woman, opinionated, hysterical when trapped, always arguing to win, and so extroverted that she had little respect for the subjective side of life, which was of such importance to her daughter. She would win confidences out of the girl only to use them against her in winning an argument with no regard for their intrinsic validity. On the other hand, I think it should be said that she was brilliant and witty, with gay aspects, adventurous, attractive, but it was not until much later that the daughter was able to appreciate it. Now, the father in this situation played a very minor role. He was gentle and passive, and his achievement was powered by his wife's animus. It was said that he didn't know he had any children. When they were away in boarding school, he wrote them only one letter. The daughter was a little puzzled to get a letter which began, "Dear son," until she could compared notes with her four brothers and found that he'd written the same letter to all of them via carbon copy. Against this background, the girl became reticent and secretive. Not being as quick as her mother, she had to do things that were rebellious. She became cold-bloodedly determined to have her own way, to refuse to give in, to develop independence and self-reliance. These traits are animus attributes, which are all right as long as the woman is running them. But when they became so exaggerated that they stole libido from the female side, they caused great problems for her. The only Eros quality left was sexuality, and this was largely as a reaction against the mother's puritanical repression. She married a man somewhat like her father, though less practical and more imaginative. He was drawn to her unconsciously as a strong mother who could help him to realize his potentiality. The conscious reason for marriage was to legalize their sexuality. She insisted that it be taken in that light, and he, warning her badly enough, agreed and tried to suppress his feelings. There was no church wedding, no honeymoon. She would actually rather have maintained their secret alliance. More modern and feminist, her animus said. Well, you know, in actual fact, this was written some time ago, and I wouldn't talk just this way now, because I watch these young people, and I worked in the student health service for many years at Cal, and during the most exciting, which was considered to be very naughty and wicked years, because that was, as you all know, the cradle where all the enormous explosion took place over Vietnam and over all the student fitness. But their great passion was give up Logos and move into Eros. It was an enormously exciting time. And so I had the feeling, I watched these young people entering into relationships and love relationships, and it was most impressive to see how hard they worked at it and see the men's castration anxiety beginning to diminish, so that they actually, the women then could begin to explain to them that sexuality actually had something to do with feeling. It even had something to do with relationship. This is astounding news to the men. They hadn't heard that before. And all kinds of wonderful things were happening in this interaction. And so I had the feeling that, although they might not end up being together, that they were serious enough about it so that they didn't just bounce from one to the next. It was not a time in the world I lived in of promiscuity, though that's what it was called by the more conservative members of the community. So as you see, I would not be sound as critical as I seem to sound in this sympathetic way. However, he persuaded her that the game of hide and seek wasted too much time and energy. At the time that these people were young, you see, they were a little ahead of their time, because there was still a terrible prejudice against people. They used to call young people living together living in sin. That's the word for it, wasn't it? Nice. And that's what they talked about. So they had to dodge from cabbage bush to cabbage bush, and from prawn to prawn, and it was all had to be very much under the table. And he didn't like that, because he was proud of her, and he didn't want to have to do it in a concealed way. And he also was afraid that maybe Mary Stokes and Margaret Sanger hadn't really done their job well enough, so that it was absolutely sure that they wouldn't have any dearest babies, and illegitimate children were not that well thought of in those days either. So at any rate, they got married. And she was not very, really very, very happy about this. And the husband tried to achieve peace at any price, but she criticized him, tried to reduce everything to fundamentals. And their roles were really reversed. At least from the traditional sort of stereotype way they were reversed. She was running the show, and he was running around touching his forelock and saying, "Yes, ma'am," and trying to do everything he could to hold things together. After several years of internecine warfare, he became resentful and whiny and defeated. By this time, they were in their 30s, they had 3 children, and they felt that they must work it out. And so they were emotionally exhausted and desperate. They both turned to analysis to help and began to discover their shadow. And she had a dream representing this, in which she saw the wall of a tenement building falling down, disclosing misery, poverty, and grime. I'm not going to go into all of this. He also was struggling with an awful lot of smelly stuff in his own psyche. And things were beginning to look up, and the children were in better shape because Mummy and Daddy were doing better together. And she began even to squeeze in some professional training for herself. And then the wife developed an overpowering confidence to her analyst. With his help, this was no mean analyst, with his help, she was able to understand and integrate the experience of the animus in which he was focused in a truly definitive way. Several dreams are put in here. One, she dreamed that she was a young girl walking in the woods with her father and that she was his mistress. Her father, of so little importance in her conscious life, has become all important in her unconscious. His suppressed eros side, not only sexual but in a far broader sense, had filtered into her unconscious and united with all of that side that she had repressed in herself. Thus bound to him, she had been unable to make a full relationship with a man of her own generation. You can see my daughter wouldn't think much of all this stuff. Later she dreamed, X, that is the analyst, and I are sitting at a table in the courtyard of an inn. We eat and talk. After the meal, we get up and say goodbye. There is sadness, but no regret, and we both know it is final. I must go to my fourth child, Tiana is three, really, a young, illegitimate boy. This, of course, was a transformation dream, and her experience with the analyst came to an end, and they parted on good terms. And the fourth child represented the psychological product of their work together, and soon afterwards, by now she had moved back wholeheartedly into her marriage. Soon afterwards she had the following dream. I'm at a large party. There are many people, some familiar, some unfamiliar, some distinguished, some not. My analyst steps out of the crowd and sees me and asks me to come with him. He wants me to meet a very important person. He leads me to my husband, smiles, and disappears. So this really was more or less the completion of the transformation. But of course there's a fly in the ointment, because the husband, while all of this has been going on, was feeling more and more left out, more and more resentful, and he was half-consciously looking for trouble, and he began to get a roving eye, and of course in a situation like that he found trouble. And he fell in love with another woman. But he had enough insight to realize that he had to take the affair as an anima experience to be worked through, and he sweated over his unconscious superior with his analyst, with whose help he was able finally to detach his anima projection and relate it to his ego. And he came back into the marriage more male than he had ever been, no longer possessed by his anima, which now served him as a relating function in his outer life and as a connection with his inner life. The deeper creative layers of the unconscious. This also shows the extent of participation by the therapist, the story of the wounds analysis. The essential reciprocity, but without breaching the sex taboo. I would just mention here, it's a point that Jane raised this morning. She said that I disagreed with her about the anima in men being the relating thing. And I just wanted to throw in that when Bill wrote the first Bill Wilson wrote the first chapter in his book on psychological types and on feeling, when he spoke attributed eros to the feeling function. This was a song I've been singing for many years, but I've been singing it solo. So I flung my arms around his neck. I was so overjoyed to have a fellow traveler, because all the eros that had always been linked to the anima and to the woman. And Guggenbill really hits that one hard and says, let's break up this linkage between woman, feeling, eros, and man, thinking, logo. You just ought to stick around our house for a while and you'll find out where the logos was and where the eros was. Things, now that we're getting old, we're getting all mixed up, because we're all, we're ungrateful, you know, everything goes every which way, and that's part of the developing of the intimacy that has developed between us through the years, because it is. I think anybody who thinks that intimacy can be it is like Beethoven said to me is mistaking the projection and counterprojection phenomenon as the big cheese. And of course it is the scala, but the thing that really means something. We've been hanging around together for 49 years, which is the longest time, and we never possibly could have made it if he hadn't been willing to do battle. It's been, as Tocqueville says, it's no picnic. And yet, it is enormously worth it, because in terms of intimacy, if I project a whole lot of anima gobbledygook on Jane, then I'm really having an ecstatic autoerotic relationship with my anima, which is perfectly peachy and feels wonderful, but it doesn't enhance the relationship any. And if I can reel back most of that stuff, nobody ever gets it all done, I'm sure, and Jane is busy reeling away too, why then we can really perceive each other more or less as we actually are. And that's something. And that's worth its weight in solid platinum. So I guess, why don't I shut up and we take maybe a 5-minute break, and then you be possible out of such confused welder to ask a question. Have a go at it. Afraid I may be asked to hand in my epaulettes and my sword as I leave the house after that answer. To tell you the truth, though during the time, particularly that I was in Zurich, and some of the analytic spins I've had since, because for ever since 1932, up to 2 years ago, every 5 years at least, I've gone back for more analysis. And of course, the older you get, the more you have to go with your great and dear and beloved friends, which everybody knows is impossible, but what the hell else are you going to do, you know? And so I had a few dreams with Joe that have been meaningful to me, but in my own work, at the receiving end of the analytical thing, and also in my work at the dispensing end, I am so much involved in the back and forth relatedness with the people that I'm working with. And there was where I had this very close and understanding relationship with Friedrich von Reichmann, who functioned in the same way. Those of you who have seen or read, I think it's now out as a movie, but who have read I Never Promised You a Rose Garden, that of course, Dr. Freed is Frieda. And I knew that girl. In fact, when I used to go to Chef and Mark very often, when I had quite a few conversations with her during the course of some of these awful things that she described in that book. But Frieda didn't use dreams very much, and when I have patients who spontaneously produce dreams, and I've worked best, I guess, with type-wise, with the same ones that where my beloved intimate men friends have come from, namely introverted intuitive thinking types, or thinking intuitive types. They, of course, tend spontaneously to produce dreams of dreams. And I have, of course, responded and got into it very much with them. But there have been other people who are more perhaps like myself, who don't produce. I always used to be enormously embarrassed in Zurich because everybody was having marvelous dreams. You know, they were going for cruises in the Mediterranean and the belly of a whale, and they were doing all these outstanding things, impaling dragons on their spears. And I would have a dream of a little woolly gray dog walking diagonally across the street. And I could still see Tony looking at me and saying, do you have any associations to this woolly gray dog? Do you have any association to that street? Never thought. To diagonals? And then she would look at me, and she had a cigarette holder about this long. And she'd take a drag on her cigarette, and then she'd go. And I got hideously ashamed, you know, and I creep out of the place. But now in my dotage, I have a feeling that the dreams will be coming back again. But most of and I have stumbled into the collective. It isn't, but without benefit of dreams, there's quite a lot of active imagination. I can, you know, they think extroverts have a hard time relating to the unconscious. Well, I've been trying to claw my way out of it all my life. I think just say boo to me, I fall in and start splashing around. So that had to do with the fact that my ego was somewhat smaller than a grain of salt. And this isn't large and doesn't anchor you very securely in the outer surround. So I think this explains my something in it. But when it came to dreams, it was always very awkward. And it may be that the more I got in touch with Chumash in this journey, this last final journey, the more they will come. But actually, it seems to come more. For instance, when I was working with Jung, and this will give you an indication of Jung's field book, too. Was not something. He said, he looked at me and he said, well, you're a very mother-drowned young man, aren't you? And I looked through the booth of the door and I thought, well, I guess I better go. And I said, well, I suppose I am. And he said, I thought so. Well, now look, I've been listening about mothers for 40 years, and if I hear the very word mentioned just once more, I'm just likely to get up and walk out. He said, I've reached the limit of my tolerance. Now, my friend Tony Wolf, she's a bottomless pit. He said, you should go and see her. Hell, she'll talk about your mother every day for and he said, now you have something really interesting. When you have some stuff from the collective unconscious, then we can talk about that. Well, within about 20 minutes, I went to Einstein and McGinnis, and there was this black Madonna. And my German isn't really famous, but it's rather hysterical, but I could rattle away. And so I went up to one of the priests and said, about that black babe there with the little child in her lap. And he said, oh, yes, she was at the Virgin Mary Crossing and the interpreters. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, oh, yes, they were scorched in the fire. And I went back and I had a look at my foot, fire in my eye. And then, it fell out of my consciousness. And within about 2 or 3 days, I had a dream about being initiated into the rites of Isis. And I didn't know where that came from. It was enormously moving and exciting, and I recited this to Jung. And Jung had a way when he was bored, he smoked a pipe constantly, and he had a little brass Chinese pot at his desk. When he was bored, he kept pulling this damn pipe apart and pouring spit into the little pot. So you knew things were going very badly. It's got to be a little more bracing or else the hour would be cut short. Well, he was sitting there and he couple of poured a little spit into the pipe, expecting, you know, to go through one of these wretched hours with me. And then I told him his dream. Oh, my God. he sat up in the edge of his chair and he did no more spit, and he said, well, where have you been? I said, Dean, what way can you go in this place? Everybody's so introverted, they're walking up and down the hill. Associating with their dreams and all that stuff. And I get these really great dogs, and I have nothing to associate about. And all I can do, the most exciting thing I can do, is to go to Springlee's and have a high chocolate with Schwandram, a hot chocolate with whipped cream. I thought that was a very daring thing to do. And that was my thing. I remember also on the way there, once in the Bahnhofstrasse, bumping into Barbara Hanna. And she was walking along, having an act of imagination, and decided, I think she was, really. And I stuck my head under in front of her face and said, hello, Barbara. And she returned from wherever she had been, and she said, hello, Joe. Where are you going? And I said, well, Barbara, I'm trying to scare up a little excitement. I'm going to go to Springle's and have a hot chocolate. And she said, well, how extraordinary. Anyway, so I said, I hadn't been anywhere, there wasn't anywhere to go except Springlee's, and I keep out of the woods because there were all these people going to dreams and things. And he said, no, and I was like, well, where did you? I said, oh, well, friends of ours did take us to Einfield. Ah, he said, that explains it. I said, doesn't explain anything for me. What are you talking about? He said, did you see a black Madonna? Yes. Did you ask how it got that way? Yes. And the monk told you that it had been scorched in a fire? Yes. Did you believe that? No. And he said, well, there you are, aren't you? I said, well, but at any rate, believe it or not, so that did come from a dream, but the dream was a reaction to something, to a happening, you could say. Yeah. Well, that's a rather roundabout answer. I don't even know if I have. Yeah, I guess I did. Say the first part of that. The most of what? Being caused by crises with patients? No. Now, there have been, as I allowed you to people to why I have gone for that reason, because I was pretty associated with being a cool touché, and because I was really pushed beyond my capacity to be able to function, or felt I was, and but certainly no. I had very firmly fixed in my life that that Freud was right, that it was irresponsible, unresponsible, whatever the word is, that it was not responsible for somebody working with people as I was, not to go and have 3, 6, 9 months or a year of analysis at least every 5 years, so that you could sort of keep in touch and keep up. Because a lot of the things that were coming up from the unconscious, of course, I was not able, I didn't feel to adequately handle myself. So I thought this as a principle, I mean, well, more than a principle, I just thought it wasn't responsible unless I did. So the answer to your question is, no, not all of the, by any means, of my returns to analysts were done for that. But I sometimes, I'm unhappy to tell you, had to pepper in some extra stuff, as well as the 5-year period that I had fixed in my noggin. I also had to sneak in from time to time in between time. And that was usually because some patient had challenged me in a way, or I'd got some terrific anima fixer. Jung told me something very reprehensible once earlier, and he said, you know, you should make it a point whenever a woman comes into your consulting room, and he said, as far as I can tell, I don't have to say this to you about men, but I'm saying it about women, you should make it a point whenever a woman comes into your consulting room to let your fantasy run. And I said, do you mean what I think you mean?
independence and individuality as one of five liberations. In this way, hopefully, men as well as women would regain appreciation and respect for themselves and for each other as total human beings. Towards this end, I submit the feminist movement might consider switching its slogan from equal and alike to equal but different, and adopt the approach of another beleaguered contingent of society by taking as a rally cry, "Female is beautiful." My mother was so educated, all that mattered was education. And she picked out the best school she could find in the country, and it happened to be in the East.
So were they aware of this problem?
They were not. I wasn't. Nobody was.
Nobody discussed it.
Nobody. They just sent me East, and there I was.
And the second question was, you said that if a woman is acquainted with a feminine, that helps her improve. What's the foundation?
Just in my practice. I've seen it in my practice, that's all. Oh, I couldn't prove it statistically, no. Not possibly, but I suspect it may extend beyond my practice, because it just seems to happen. They come in with colds and lots of flu and all kinds of ailments, and it's get around to their own real selves, which is the female. I mean, their real individuality, which is a female individuality, and the animus no longer runs in ragged, they just can help you. That's my experience. That's all.
Could I get in just one word here in response to this? Because it's an answer to your first question, when they had the annual dances there. And one year, Eddie was invited to go to this dance. And her twin brother, who was the biggest sailor, who came back up to his own background, the biggest sailor he could think of, he was known incidentally as the strongest man in the school. And he went around and said, "My sister's absolutely wonderful. She could beat me up."
I'm having a little trouble just taking it on faith. I just think that Christianity started out all right. I've seen some marvelous stuff in the early documents, and I would have no quarrel with that. But it was captured somehow by the patriarchal masculine thing, and it has something to do, I suppose, with the whole Western culture. Which came first, I don't know.
Okay, so what I mean is, when you talk about the mind of Christianity, are you talking about a cultural phenomenon more than religion?
Yes. Okay. I don't know anything about religion. I never went to church until I was about almost 17. So I never felt more easy.
I wanted to make some exceptions to your general advice about feminists. I think that a lot of feminists would agree exactly with what you just said.
Oh, would they?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I think that's marvelous.
Yeah.
I
want it. I agree with you.
Oh, great. I've had a lot of, you get all balled up because of your the various ways of expressing things with people that don't have your lingo. I mean, I have my lingo and they have their lingo, and sometimes it's hard to get together on it.
On that, Jim, I look up
the suffragettes were feminists.
Yeah.
Because way back there, I heard about them. They were throwing bricks and all kinds of things.
And Jane, what about Abigail Adams, who wrote about a funny letter to dear old John and said, you're going to write a constitution in which women aren't considered equal billing the men? What the hell are you doing?
Yeah. It wasn't a new idea, I think, but it became, that's interesting. That's interesting, yes, and it doesn't speak of being alike either.
In the case of identical twins, you find that they're with either man or woman, since you were twins, but they're twins with a brother.
Couldn't be identical.
Pardon? Yeah, but what I am thinking in terms of identical twins, either male or female, do you find that the parallel of their development of the animus or the animos is equal in identical twins, or is it just another complete different makeup psychically?
I don't know. I know they're very, very close. They're very with my brother and me. Being twins, we followed the same quite separately. Actually, we followed the same.
Well, obviously you would, but I was thinking of identical girls, for instance. Would their animus develop rather as a parallel as they grow?
Maybe somebody could answer that. I bet certain ignorant on the subject. Could someone answer that?
I can't answer that. I have another question.
I just don't know. I don't know enough identity. What's imprinted in those very earliest months of life and what is inherited. We just don't know.
I'll pick up something on that because I'm thinking of Marnie and Nancy. I'm thinking of identical twins that we both know who were in school.
That's right.
And these two girls had animus that was certainly quite different. One of them married a guy who was considerably to the right of our friend Berber Nixon. And the other one married a guy who was considerably to the left of Brother McGovern. So,
I think siblings will push each other opposite directions. That happens, yeah.
I think we have one more question back there. Anyone have to stay? back.
The question I had was, when you were talking about the shadow in which there were more similarities, you said it was avoided by both men and women, and I was asking for some clarification on why avoid similarities and the things in the shadow.
Having the same wound, so to speak. That's my daughter's theory, and I really don't quite know what she means. But she finds it happening in her practice, and I know what you mean. But I've seen it too, a lot. That people get together on it, but for some reason or other, it's hard for them to admit it. And then, but if they can admit it, then they have a companionship going. I think that's it. But it remains in the shadow because it's unconscious, and it's something they like. You know, somebody wants a room, they just push it off that way. I think that's all it is.
Our speaker this afternoon is one of the Americans who early recognized the genius of Jung and stayed in Zurich to analyze with him and study under him. He's a pioneer of analytical psychology in this country, one of the founders of the C.G. Jung Institute in San Francisco. He's a former president of the International Association for Analytical Psychology, and as a longtime student of Jung's psychology, he's a co-author of a type survey that probably a number of you have taken. As you may know, a number of people interested in Jungian psychology and influenced by Jung are sectarian. Our speaker, in contrast, has worked very hard over the years to make a place for Jungian psychology in the larger field of psychology, psychiatry, and mental health professions. He's a master analyst, and for many reasons has been very important as a shaping influence in the establishment and further development of analytical psychology in this country and in the world. I loved every minute of it, Bill. I only wish it were true. That was a very, very handsome introduction. I am at least as disorganized as my life is organized, so that I sometimes think that the inside of my head more closely resembles a washing machine in motion than anything else. So if you're looking for, after this very generous introduction of Bill's, for something that has a beginning and a middle and an end, I'm afraid it won't be quite like that. I tried to address myself to the subject of intimacy, and I get all of the little islands, and then I go skidding off, and it's been extremely difficult to put it together. So I thought maybe this would be the time when I would deliver a speech in sequence, but I warn you, it is not. It is not the time. I think actually that that intimacy was of great interest to me. Sally really was the one who picked up on it. I'd given some seminars on this at our institute in San Francisco, and for me, I suppose really that it is the story of my life. I mean to say that intimacy is of enormous importance to me, and I think that really along with it, I found that relationship is the thing that I value very much and have all these years above everything else. I mean, I have shocked people by saying that thinking was all very well when you got home, if you weren't too tired at night, you didn't want to go for a walk, or you didn't want to play the piano, well, you could think for a little bit, and it was all right. This is a rather cavalier way to treat thinking in. So at any rate, it only indicates the fact that relationship has been important. And for me, of course, I suppose I think our chickens are here to become. And intimacy and relationship favor this for me. The dictionary says that this is Random House Dictionary. It's not responsible for me. Actually, I suddenly thought I've got to find out which dictionary it is. But I did it. Sensation is not really my thing either. It says, close, familiar, and usually affectionate or loving personal relationship with another person or group. Well, having, after reading that, I saw that I hysterically, I write things in envelopes. I stop my car in the street and start writing, which annoys the citizens quite a lot. And I had written rather hysterically and almost indecipherably, deep intimacy can only occur between two persons. And then I read what the Random House brothers had to say, and they talked about it being with a group. Well, I would say to that indeed one can establish some kind of relatedness, and perhaps intimacy is not too strong a word, with a group, but that particularly when it comes to friendship and relationship of a meaningful sort, that at least promiscuity or too many people will preclude the chance of intimacy. When I came out first to Santa Barbara some weeks ago in 1926 or 27, I remember I started to court Jane and she said to me, we got on the subject of friends, and I said, oh yes, I have quite a few best friends. And she said, you have what? And I said, I have quite a few best friends. And she said, how many would you say? And I said, oh, 50. And I thought she was going to leave me then and there. Well, I didn't have a very good grip on intimacy at that point. And I think it's rather misleading when you get people with a very strong feeling function who are very keen on relating, that it is not always, it isn't always the same thing. I mean, you can have very good and warm relatedness with people, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're into the field of real intimacy. Jane said that she would define intimacy as sharing thoughts. Well, of course, you can see from what I've already said that that's not just my definition, and I would think of it as revealing each other to each other, I guess would be the best that I could do with that. And so I thought that I would say one more thing about the feeling function, that one of the other analysts in our group pointed out to me that oftentimes, particularly in therapy, I think that feeling types tend sometimes to use feeling as a defense, in the same way that intellectuals, the thinking types, use thinking as a defense, interpretation. You know, they clear their throats and make an interpretation, and that's marvelous, and little blue flashes are supposed to occur. But the feeling type is likely to use relatedness and his feeling in that way. I thought that was kind of an interesting downplay for the feeling function, and more or less relevant to the subject. I thought that I would try and have a look or think of intimacy under various headings. That would be intimacy with oneself, and intimacy with men, intimacy with women, intimacy with both socially and professionally, and so I have a bunch of scattered, very scattered thoughts about these different areas. Now, when it comes first, I think that perhaps first I would like to say something about intimacy with oneself, because that's how we all got into this racket. It's very interesting, and I can still see the faces of Barbara Hannah and Malus in France, and and leaping in the front row at Esther Harding's 80th birthday party when I got up and made a stirring speech on marriage in the second half of life. And in the midst of it, I had a kind of animus there about how much I resented having to go ahead digging away at consciousness and working and hoping that someday a geranium and a flower pot would come out of the top of my head and the bell would ring and I would get a 5-cent cigar or whatever you get when you're in the sleep. And I said, but I guess that the hallmark of Jungians is that we're all hooked on this growth process thing. And obviously, my three friends in the front row, they just love it. They like it better than drinking or making love or going to the movies or anything. And for me, I find it sort of a burden. And I get terribly resentful, and I wish I was just a farmer out there wondering if it's going to rain tomorrow so the beans will grow. And this had mixed reactions, as you can imagine, in the audience. In any case, in those days, people who wanted to be analysts didn't know that. All they knew was that they, most of us, I think, were the world were rocking at home between the man and the woman. So that they went, they had a neurosis that most of my generation reached from here to Keokuk, Iowa, and so that they went to out of urgency and need for their own neurosis to be worked on. So they were being forced, in other words, into this, getting into this consciousness business and getting into the unconscious and beginning to establish some sort of connection with oneself. And it was only as an afterthought that it occurred to us that we might be analysts. I remember saying to Jung after I had seen him a few times, I know it's very brash of me, but you think I'm mad, I'm very neurotic, of course, but you think maybe, perhaps, when I, well, let me say, later on, I could try and do what you do? And he threw his hands up and he said, oh, God, they all say that. It's just the conference, he said. I didn't think it would start so quickly. And I said, oh, no, I'm different. I suppose my genes and the conditions of life and perhaps the fact that I was fired from Harvard, which was somewhat unsettling at the time, although now I look upon it as outside of my father's going bankrupt, it's probably the most helpful thing that happened to me in my youth, but it didn't seem so then, and these things, I guess, precipitated all of this, but I got boxed into this business, so I think some of us are rather reluctant dragons about getting into intimacy with ourselves, particularly in younger years. I think when one gets to be an old thing, as such as Jane and I have managed to so far to do, knocking on wood, I think then that there is a very natural movement. You see me moving around at meetings, nobody would ever dream that I could even pronounce the word introversion, but in point of fact, we have a place with kerosene lamps and windows and one thing and another that is in real wilderness. And there's nobody except ourselves who speaks any language other than Gopher, Roadrunner, Hawk, and various other languages that you may not speak fluently yourself. And and this also happens to be a place where, at point conception, where the Chumash mash, they had been very proud, and the Chumash Indians all took off for the Never Never Land. I mean, after they threw the switch, they went to heaven. But their takeoff point was just below our house. And I find myself, we've been locked in there in the wintertime for 9 days, 13 days, 14 days at a time by rain and weather and one thing and another. We're in the dirt road up in the mountains. And really what we're up to is working on the time where we take off from point conception and join our Chumash friends. And so that this is a kind of a natural movement that establishes some sort of inner, and this time I'm not fucking and winging about it. I'm also not going back as frequently as I used to have another analytical spin. Freud said any responsible person would go back every 5 years if he was working with people, and that somebody tinker with his psyche again. And I've done this conscientiously, but at the age of 70, I was working with my friend Joe Henderson, and I suddenly said, God damn it, Joe, I've had enough, I'm getting out of here. I'm terribly resentful. I want to go to the movies, I want to do get drunk, I'm just not going to do it. But the kind of thing that is going now on now, really, I suppose, it could be subsumed under the headings of reeling back as far as possible the projections that one has on persons and places and things. And this is an enormously introverted setting in which to struggle with this project. And because I've seen a lot of people go out screaming, and I, because once I was a real doctor, that was many years ago, I don't, I'm sort of a horse doctor now, but I saw them go out screaming, and I realized gradually the reason that was like that for them often was because they had so many projections and so many threads. They were like a picture I remember once in my Gulliver's Travels of Gulliver, but it was the lily pups, and they had all these tiny little threads, but you get enough of them, and gosh, it's pretty painful to have them bust one. So I'm busy reeling in the threads so that when I go, there'll be a minimum of strings to bust. Jung coined a very felicitous phrase, I think. He said, if you've discharged your debts as far as you can to your genes and to society, you may be lucky enough to live yourself out of luck. So I would say that this is the task that's going on now. And so this time, the intimacy with myself is really very welcome. And it's an interesting kind of intimacy because as you get old, it involves not only coming to terms with your own past and with history, but also, of course, with evolution. And so that it's a curious, there's a lot of impersonality in it. And yet, I certainly would put it under the general head of intimacy. I'm going to have to watch myself because I would love to get into some kind of a back and forthness, and so I don't want to just pour all this stuff on you too long. I want to leave time for interaction for us. Now the business of intimacy between with patients, perhaps I will and I think actually, I'll try and go into the intimacy thing with patients under that heading next. And I'm taking excerpts here from I'm taking excerpts, so I am cheating and doing a little bit of reading myself from. A book that I have in press with the revealing title of St. George and the Dandelion, which is a very intellectual title. I suppose this has to do with the heading is screening of patients. I suppose one of the most important things for me as a therapist begins before I do anything at all, namely screening. I consider myself really fortunate to have been able to pick and choose whom I work with, which has been the case in the last 25, 30 years. This has not been done on an elitist basis. It's been done in terms of my own limitations. Because the very fact that I have certain gifts means the price of admission is that I have certain un-gifts. And if somebody comes along who needs the kind of stuff I have only on my ungifted side, they'd be better off if they went to the movies. They would be less damaged. To me, it is utter nonsense to think that everybody can be equally good with all kinds of people. So usually I have two or three preliminary interviews with prospective patients to give us a chance to size each other up. And unless all the little green lights go on inside my cranium, I suggest that they go to one of my colleagues. For my part, I want to make sure, in the first place, that we can communicate. Speak a language that seems to make sense to each other, In the second place, that there can be mutual trust. And in the third place, that I can actively believe in whomever I work with. I don't think it's enough to just passively accept people. I suppose if a one-legged pea-green man came in and announced that he enjoyed cohabiting with sheep, I could probably sit there and not be too upset about it. I might even smile. But I think it has to be more than this. And this kind of preliminary screening means that I really have not worked with anybody unless I felt that these conditions were met and that somehow or other, whoever it was, man or woman, and I, had enough meaning for each other so that it would lead toward intimacy. That's what the screening really is all about, because I look upon the analytic process as a reciprocal effort. From the foregoing, it will be obvious that for me, the interaction between myself and the patient is the crucial thing, and I struggle hard to try and describe what in heaven's name it is that I do. This is very difficult indeed, but one way I have of putting it is that when I'm working with somebody, I hook one of my legs very tightly around the leg of my chair, and then I dispatch myself into the skin of my patient, hang around there for a while, reel myself back out again, and try to figure out what would seem to be going on while I was inside the patient's skin. That's one way to say it. Another way, that's of course the scientific way to say it, and another way, hardly more scientific, would be that I think of it as plugging in with absolute concentration. Something else that's important for me is to be no different in my consulting room from the way I am with my family or friends. Otherwise, intimacy would be impossible for me with a patient. Now, there are some differences. I don't make love to my patients, for instance, you'd be happy to hear. But on the other hand, I will laugh, or I will cry. And another difference is that I'm more focused on the other person than I might be when I'm with a friend. After all, at 35 smackers an hour, I think they're entitled to getting a little focusing. But I don't have the feeling of dispensing knowledge to swine who come in to kiss my shoes, nor do I use any sort of facade, which would, of course, interfere with intimacy. If I ever do use technique or facade, it's a sure thing that I'm doing it not for the patient's sake, but for my own, because I'm going down for the third time. And, you know, sometimes patients, to one, well, it makes one very nervous to realize that the patient in certain areas is way ahead of where one is oneself. This is rather unnerving. Well, anyway, when I fall back on any kind of technical device, all I'm trying to do is to protect myself from dissolution, that's all. So I've learned to treat therapy as a relationship, a process, and I try very hard to keep my theories out of this process because I don't want anything interfering with my immediate experience, my immediate contact with the patient. All that theory in my head isn't so important. Too much conscious concern with it tends to distort my observation and experience of the patient's quality. What is important, the indication of successful therapy for me, is that both of us change, that we're touched by each other and grow. I would say here, emphasize that not only do I not make love to my patients, but that I am a very violently opposed to any to sex getting into the analytic relationship. You may wonder why I even bother to mention such a thing, but I just, because a lecture at a meeting of the Academy of Psychoanalysis, which I belong to in New York last December, that gave some statistics, and it's really hair-raising how much raising and lowering is going on the couch. It's really hair-raising, and so I just think that sex and therapy simply do not mix, and I think that although there may be sufficient participation by the analyst in the process, because sure as hell he's involved in it. If you're going to have intimacy, it's got to be a mutual thing. But the, and it may be, in fact, it almost inevitably would be that sex will occur to, you know, you think what a peachy idea that would be. But on the other hand, I think that the denial of this may, in a way, enhance the process and enhance the increase in consciousness that can come from the experience. So I just mentioned that. I would also like to comment that I think diagnosis is a terribly dangerous thing. I'm enormously opposed to it in the field of therapy, which of course my medical brethren, from whom I disidentify myself quite strongly, because I'm not very keen on MDs, to tell you the truth, I'm enormously opposed to it in the field of therapy, because if I start diagnosing people, then immediately, and now I'm back again on something that would interfere with the interaction between myself and my patients, then immediately all the things that I've read or learned about anxiety states or hysteria conversions or schizophrenia or manic depressives or whatever come flooding into my head. It's as if I'd pushed a button and all this knowledge pours through the floodgates and gets between me and the person I'm working with. I used to say that before I'd start work with a patient, I'd rush in and grab an eraser off the blackboard and scrub my cortex absolutely clean, as if then would be nothing at all between me and the patient. The scrubbing wouldn't take very long. I feel it is desirable to establish a relatively informal setting and to minimize the authoritarian implications inherent in the therapeutic situation. In this connection, I recall a day I spent with Jung in 1951 at his country place in Bollingen. It was the first time that I'd been back to Switzerland since the war. I'd left in 1939, about 13 years earlier. He said, "I know you're doing all right." And I beamed from ear to ear and wagged my tail, and he said, "In spite of the fact that you're an MD," and then grinned. What he was talking about, of course, was the archetypal thing that the Jungians, including Jung himself, have been so enormously focused on, the whole tradition of the shaman, the healer, and the danger of identification with it. And, of course, this is bound to happen when you think you're across between Mahatma Gandhi, Red Grange, Joe Namath, and Siegfried. I'm sure there are some others I might have mentioned, but that'll do. And this isn't very good, really, for the therapeutic process. But, of course, the analysts who engage in this kind of intimacy are risking themselves very much. And there are times when you really are pushed beyond your limits by some people. And then there is a thing called the hero archetype that is a very tempting thing. For me, my favorite one was St. George. So when I worked with patients and realized that their needs and the place that they were moving around in was very frightening and required a total mobilization of myself to be able to meet them and to accompany them and to match them, and you're not quite sure whether you've got it in you or not, and maybe you would be able to do it with about that much left over, well, that's a very scary thing. And at that point, sometimes I would find myself being taken over by the St. George image. Now, I wouldn't look in the mirror and see myself in my shining armor, you know, galloping across the fields, waving my spear, but it would be something like a squirt of monkey gun. It gave me the ability to do a lot of things and have all sorts of strength and courage that I don't normally have. But it was also a very fearsome thing, a little bit like putting a Porsche motor into a Volkswagen. Just not quite up to it. And of course also there is this terrible blocking that comes from being identified with the outside. So then my usual reaction was grumbling every step of the way to go back and have another spin with my favorite analyst. One thing that favors a reality-based relationship and intimacy between analyst and patient implies rapport and reactivity on the part of the analyst is the fact that we do not use a couch, that we use the vis-a-vis position. Now, in London, most of the Jungians had flipped around the corner and bought a couch, but as you know, in this country we don't. I happen to have a couch, but I rather resent anybody using it but me, and I usually catch 40 winks after lunch or something like that, so it's been quite useful. I have used it some with patients, but my reason usually was when they got into such a state of verbal constipation that we just sat there breathing, and I'm not very comfortable with that myself, and I also feel it's rather expensive breathing for patients, and but then I might put them on a couch where they couldn't see my beady eyes and could just look at my rubbing of an angel from Uncle Bob or something, and that was how I used it, but I use it very, very little. And of course, in engaging in this way, one avoids anonymity, which in many therapeutic circles is considered to be very desirable. We were saying at lunch that the good classical idea is that you sit behind you of the psychoanalytic world, that you sit behind your patient, keeping your mouth shut and your bowels open, and breathing, and denying any sort of relationship. While this favors the production of transference, no doubt, it precludes any kind of intimacy. But Jung's notion of having concurrently with the transference, counter-transference thing, the reality-based relationship, of course, is where all of this becomes possible. And I'm fully convinced that one doesn't have to favor and structure things in order to encourage transference. What has to get projected, it will get projected sure as hell, and you don't have to angle for it. And I heard Jung in an altercation in 1936 in London. He was being rather beleaguered by his Freudian colleagues who felt he wasn't giving enough of a plug for the transference, and he said, he got very purple in the face, and he said, well, you know, transference is only a substitute for a relationship after all, and I've done my best work where there wasn't any transference at all. He just screamed at these people, and then everybody calmed down. I feel in developing the intimacy with my patient that I make an alliance with the healthy aspects of the patient. And so that my primary focus, as I just true for all humans, is on health, not psychopathology. Well, I think that perhaps that is that's enough on the intimacy thing between between the analyst and the patient. Well, there's one thing I can't resist mentioning, and that is that a lot of people seem to think that, and this is particularly true at Bandy Porter, which is where I taught for many, many years at the psychiatric hospital and wing of the University of California Medical School. And there got to be a vogue along in the early 50s for pain as an indicator of how well your analysis was going. And I would hear residents boasting to each other, my analysis is better than yours. Not even say my analysis can lick your analysis. He'd say, my analysis is better than yours. Well, why is that? Well, how many times did you cry last week? Well, I only cried just a little bit once. Oh, you would see, I cried every day. And so I hurt much more than you do, so therefore I'm better. And I remember Frieda, from Ashton, who was a beloved and very dear friend of mine, we were driving back from the party, and I said, what do you think about this pain kick? You think that this is the big cheese? And she said, oh no, I think that's just nonsense. Of course, anything that's worth having does hurt some. I don't like to arrange like this. It's poor arrangement. But at any rate, she said, I look on my analysis as a liberation. I just thought that I would mention that. If you do that, then you will have whatever sex feelings you may have in your consciousness, and then you will be able to cope with them. But if you don't, something might happen, and you'd be terribly sorry, and you'd end up in the slammer. No, you didn't say that. I said, my very feeling. Very much, and I keep finding that it still seems to be very fashionable when people are young people, so I'm doing supervision or control analysis or teaching at Cal or whatever. The young people tend to say that things are going very well, we have a good conference established. And I think to myself, not usually to myself because I'm not shy, I say, you mean that's your criteria of whether things are going well? If you've got a patient here, if your patient thinks that you're Albert Schweitzer, is that good? They say, isn't it constant to the analysis constant? I say, well, that's the be all and end all. I say, well, that was Freud's idea, and that's why he uses the couch and why he minimizes interpersonal relationships in order to promote this formation of the conference and strives for anonymity with the patients. And if they ask the analyst a question, he says with a civil and whisper, if patients will say to me, are you married? And I don't. I usually say, yeah. Have you got any children? Yeah. Grandchildren, or possibly great grandchildren, I said, yeah. And then I would say, I might then get in the other side of it and say, yeah, I have. Where did that come from? So I might cover both sides of it, my poor old mind is wandered. I get carried away in my own hot air. Will you rephrase your question? Because I've skidded badly. I'm in the next county.
I
have to have the question again. Because it's gone. I'm terribly sorry. When you get to be my age, you'll be amazed how quickly things just exit. Work without a trunk. Yeah.
Without a
trunk. Yeah. Well, I must say that for this thing, I find that the transference is not the central process, and the analysis of the transference is not usually for me the central process. And I do reveal myself enough. Sometimes it backfires on me. I'm going back to San Francisco now, for instance. On the 17th of July, a suit has been brought against our institute for $250,000 by an ex-patient of mine. He spent most of his life down in the unconscious, but he also was a man with great talent, and his great flaw was that he couldn't trust anybody. And I thought, well, if I trust this man and show him that I trust him, then maybe he'll trust me, and if he trusts me, then it might spread. He might trust some other people, and then maybe we'll break the back of this thing. So I took a deep breath and had a try, and reveal myself a lot. Naturally, this militates against the formation. The more you reveal yourself, the harder it is to make projections, because the reality keeps getting in the way of it. You know, you keep thinking, oh boy, now I'm working with Albert Schweitzer and Buber, and then I make some dumb remark and he says, oh God, it's Jerry. actually, he is now going to use all these competencies that I gave him in organizing in court and embarrassing as much as he can. So this backfired, this intimacy thing here with him. But inasmuch as you can see that intimacy is so central for the way I function, I would go along with Jung in the feeling that he actually was exaggerating, because he was never, by the brains were harassing him, and so he had an idea out there. You see, when he said that, he got a little carried away. But although he did mean what he said when he said transference is a substitute for relationship, because if you can't two human beings are in that situation and they can't make a relationship, all they can do is project. So of course they project every 50 stones, you know. But I would say, in answer to your question, that for me, inasmuch as the interaction is the big thing, and this is true with Rita, too, that that the transference is not the big key. It is not the big key. I also wanted to say something to backtrack about Rita, that in talking about intimacy with women, men and women, that she and I have, during the last 10 years of her life, a very loving and very intimate relationship, and there was, but no sex. I mean, there was, neither of us, we both were well aware of the fact, I noticed she was a woman and she noticed I was a man, but there was no sex in it. And Googleville makes a big point about this too, that there is possibility of men and women having very intimate and very strong and good feeling connections without having to go hunting and bumping, you know. So I guess, does that, Auntie, I am interested in why you asked it. if you want to say. Well, of course, it's often they say, gee, you've got a smashing kind of transfer from you to me, you know, because I say, well, little Albert Kraken, which, you know, is a fine outstanding citizen, and actually maybe a miserable man with warts all over his face, but I just happen to like him. And they say, well, and I say, well, I take exception to that, because I think I really perceive him as he is. I don't think it is kind of transfer. I distinguish, you see, I think transfer and kind of transfer as being a bundle of protection. So that what you're really dealing with is not the other fellow. You're dealing with part of your own psyche. And concurrently with that, and in my case, preponderantly with that, comes the reality-based interaction between myself and the other person. Is that still about you? Yes.
I think I heard you say that
God Almighty, I think without it, I can't think of anything terrible enough to say. Yes, I certainly do.
I agree with you on that, but what I'm wondering is, do you think that the intimacy that you have with the other person is really more than just the intimacy?
They might, you know, they might. They might. they might very well. I think when feeling types like myself tend to get chauvinistic, you know, and think that the feeling types are the big cheese. Of course, everybody sneers and laughs at it, so it's kind of counterproductive. But supposing that I did do that, then I think that I think it's very untrue. That's why I said I didn't think that intimacy was determined by sex, by gender, or by type. I think that, because after all, I had a very intimate relationship at the receiving end with Toni Wolff. And as I say, she had about as much feeling as a gopher. You know, that wasn't her thing. That's not quite fair. She was very human, you know, but feeling was not her thing, and she had a mind that was just marvelous. Just good mind. Jungian wasn't as creative as the original thing, but that was quite good point. But no, not being that.
That's it,
of course. You see, Jane brings up something that she reminded me of when I rang off a little while ago, that, she said, I'll tell you, she said, now, if she related to you through her inferior function, then you get the feeling. Now, this may be true. It may be true, you know, because I always have the feeling that the inferior function is the growing edge. I must say that. I mean, I can operate at the intuitive level and at the feeling level, and after all these years of being battered by my Freudian and pals who think their way up and down the street, and I got my thinking function up to about 3 or 4 inches above the level of the ground, and if you don't stamp your foot, it would be okay. But if you go boo at me, I wouldn't like to tell you what would happen. But when it comes to sensation, that particularly my integrated system, you know, I could be half dead of pneumonia, and I wonder why I feel so peculiar. I used to come into I used to come into my office in the afternoon. I worked quite long hours. Harding thought it was malpractice, but I would come in around 2 o'clock maybe, or 2:30 in the afternoon, and at about 4 I'd come in to change patients, and I would be seen just gruesome, and looking kind of stupid, I suppose, and I my secretary, well, sensation function, like the rocket was rolling, and naturally, I mean, I couldn't have existed without it, and she'd take one look at me and she'd say, "Have you had lunch?" And I thought, "Well, this is the most miraculous thought I'd ever heard of." No. And she'd say, "Well, I just happened to have a sandwich. Stuff that in yourself." And I'd take it and I'd skewer it, you know. So I really, sensation is not my thing. But on the other hand, it is the, for me, the, that's where the growing edge is. And so what Jenny just said, I think is very relevant, because I really think that thinking is Tony's first function, and feeling is the bottom, and somehow or other, maybe all this feeling stuff out of me mobilized it, or I don't know, maybe she has always had a sneaking wish to have a relationship with a pituitary fellow, once called a normal giant, that's me. Well, I don't know. That's the other part of Tony. Exactly, Sally, and it's a hell of a good point. And it's the point that one of the training groups that I'd lectured to on intimacy to find out what I'd said, because I couldn't remember a word of it, you know. And they said, "Well, you know, it wasn't so much what you said; it was the way you were. You were like that, and obviously that's how it is for you." Be intimate. If you're not being intimate, you don't so good. But there is something that I'm thinking about, and that is about feeling. And he said, "You know, I have an idea that feeling types use feeling as a defense, in the same way that thinking types use interpretation as a defense." I thought this was a terribly interesting thing. And it is, of course, true that if you're working on your superior functions, you've got enough facility so that you can move around. See, I don't get my feelings hurt, I get my thinking hurt. You know, about every 13 years I have an idea, you know, and if somebody says, "That's a thinking wrong," I just don't believe it. So yes, I think what Sally just said is absolutely correct. Yeah, sure. Supposing, for instance, that I'm working with Agnes McGillicuddy, who doesn't fit the topic I know, but supposing that I'm working with Agnes McGillicuddy, and she says to me, "Wouldn't I be drunk all the time?" My music would have been true. No longer true. I don't believe it that much now. I'm too old. I haven't got the energy. Anyway, supposing I had been, I'm being a little frivolous, but I'm at a loss to think something reprehensible, although I know a lot of things. But supposing that I'd be right, supposing that Angus McGillicuddy looks at me and says, "Where were you last week? What were you doing?" And then I start pouring on the feelings, and pretty soon I beguile them. You know, feeling types have to get up in the morning and fall to their knees and ask the Lord not to let them manipulate anybody to death. does that answer your question? I hate it to answer, but
I have a feeling that
Well, if you were reading Jung's Psychological Times, you might skip the first 300 pages about a fellow named Mrs. Jordan and various other things. It's pretty hard going. But the last 300 is quite breaking. And in this, when he gets to the feeling function, he says, the feeling function is a rational function and it can cut like a knife. And I do think it's true. I think that a feeling function can be so I think that is one side of it, but I would think of the more disgraceful side, the manipulative side, the feeling function. Because, you know, for a feeling function, feeling person, an intellectual is stuck through, you know, they know just how to reach them. I remember once watching, Jane and I went to look at the Bertrand Russell, whose mind was so big that it hung out of his brain pan and the trail of the ground behind him. I had never known anybody so erudite or with such an enormous mind. And we went around, we had a letter of instruction to him. And he gave this marvelous lecture. I don't know what it was now, but it was marvelous lecture. He was on the edge of their feet with him. Then we went around to the green room. And I was so nervous, I was an elderly man of 24 at the time, that I was afraid that I would go to pieces, so I had 4 or 5 questions written on the back of the envelope, you know, and I said, well, Mr. Russell, he wasn't then Lord Russell, Mr. Russell, when you were in China, and he's very, very bored, obviously, just praying that we would get lost as quick as possible, and in the midst of this rather labored interaction between him and Jane and me, in came two little ladies of the evening. It was in the afternoon, but they were there. And these two little chippies, as we used to call them, and when I was a kid in school, they came tripping across the green room, and one of them got on one side of Dirty, and the other one got on the other side, and they said, "Oh, come on, Dirty, let's get out of this. Come on, let's go down to the pub and have a nod, shall we? Come on, there's it, dear, come on. There's a knob, Dirty. And that man, that great thinker, he, all I could think of was what happens to a lump of sugar when you drop it in a cup of hot tea. and he went off to the just simple. It was the most disillusioning sight I've ever seen. That is a question that I don't think it is. It's a rather gruesome answer to give you, but I always quarrel with my Freudian pals, and I've played the other side of the street a very great deal. I'm kind of their court jester. When people accuse me of being, they say, oh, you're very rigid and very exclusive. They say, oh, no, we're very democratic and liberal. We had a union just last week, and that'll be me. So I'm there sort of, as I say, to quote a phrase that was initiated by my friend Professor Williford, the court jester for them. But they think that there's a beginning and a middle and an end to the analytic process. And I quarrel constantly with this, because I don't think there is. You see, when I pass the 2,000 mark, I mean of myself as a victim, I quit counting. So you can imagine how many dollars, francs, and other currencies I've laid out on people's tables and what I've gone through. And no, don't try and imagine what I've gone through. But at any rate, the only thing that I can say about myself or about other people is that as long as you're still breathing, you're in an ongoing process, and that stuff is going to emerge. Now, it's very different. When I go see an analyst now, I'm not climbing the walls, you know, and I don't go and say, I had to go and stay with mother last weekend, and I had a tantrum, just the way I used to when I was 4, and I'm actually 59, and it isn't very dignified, you know, I don't have to do that anymore. But there is stuff that as I've tried to make clear, that does come up, so that I just have the feeling, really, about analysis with both with my the people I work with. I kind of don't like the word patient, because it sounds as if you thought that you were some superior being who has all these poor little creatures. You know, I prefer to think of them as the people I work with. But at any rate, I have the feeling that with them and with myself, that you get more or less au jour. That is, you get more or less up to date. And then you say, well, so so long, Kitty. Not adieu, but au revoir. You know, not for goodbye forever. I'll be seeing you around. Maybe next year, maybe early tomorrow morning. So that's my answer. I don't know. Yeah. Oh, sure it is, provided you've provided it's your developed function. I can use my intuition defensively. You know, if I'm in a tough place, I just levitate out of it. I'd probably trip over the hearth rug and break my leg on the way out, but sure you can use it defensively. And you can also use it, and I think unions do this, it's a terrible thing they do, you can use it as an alibi, you know. Somebody will say to me, they present something very intellectual. I say, oh, that's I'm a beating guy. Real cop-out stuff. Or somebody will present me with a thing called facts, which I like to look at in the back of the neck, you know, but a lot of people like to look at them head on. And frankly, they're very important. But you can particularly here in the union world, where the last time we got really big figures, Catherine Bradley and I, international research project, to come out 80% innovative and 80% intuitive. Well, hell, you know, in that world, you're in a majority if you're an intuitive, so you could sneer at sensation type. Jane, for instance, who is an introverted sensation type, when we first started our training place down there, you see, we didn't know whether we had our pants on or what day it was or any of these esoterica. And she did all the dirty work, you know. She saw that we got to a meeting and that we didn't, some of us didn't come on Tuesday and some on Thursday. She got us all there Wednesday and things of that sort. And you think she got any thanks for all of this? All she got was sneers and so forth. So sure, you can use it isn't just a feeling function. You can use it.
Remind you that
you
have a date
that
the famous Stephen
Tatney
time in the bathroom down in Nashville.
Oh, so I have that, dear man.
Yes,
that's right.
One more question, and then we could move down.
Yeah, I think
that's right. Just one more. You use an example of how the reason that the relationship between men and women, including sex,
yeah.
I just wonder if you have a comment on the person, the sex person, and the young God.
Oh, yeah, I guess I'd have a comment on that. I think I would almost describe it in the same terms that Jung described a transference as a substitute for relationship. I also think, you probably will discover this, although you don't have to worry for a week or two, for a very long time, sex is the great healer. You know, when the man and the woman come to a terrible impasse and they're getting ready to punch each other in the nose, and then suddenly they're on the couch or they're on the rug or somewhere and seems to be getting the way it is. And then somehow, miraculously, everything seems to be all right. Well, when we get to be old, sex is no longer the great healer. So that such a situation you're just describing is very unlikely to occur. But I would, in answer to your question, put it in the same category as I would. I would say that it's a substitute for relationship. Yeah, yeah. Except that it's transferring at a rather primal level. I just want to say one more thing. I would also say that for men and women, I think it's very different. You know, I've always thought because women's apparatus was inside them that they therefore had a very much better idea about the relationship between sex and feeling. That these two things were just different versions of the same thing. Whereas the men, with all that stuff waving around outside, I have the feeling that. That may be why they have this awful split off sexuality that is such a social threat to the world.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.